Hey folks, welcome to the 10 Laws Podcast with East Forest. I'm East Forest. Hi. Today I have an episode with an old friend of mine named Christopher Shin. He is a playwright, lives in New York City, and I met him back in my young 20s when I first moved to New York and was an actor, and I was in one of his plays. But he's was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize in Drama. He's won Obie Awards. He's been produced all over the place internationally and in New York City and beyond. But mostly he's just a very thoughtful and brilliant guy and someone that touched my life at an early time when I was kind of coming up in my 20s. And we've lost touch a bit over the years, but not for any reason other than, you know how things goes. You move away and you're doing things. But we kind of reconnected. I think it was on Marco Polo. You know that little app where you can send videos? And sometimes if it's a friend of yours, they can just send you one. He just sent me one. And basically that started things. And we got back in touch. And he was one of the first people I wanted to talk to when I was getting this podcast started. It actually took me like 2 years from saying I wanted to do a podcast to actually making it happen. But I asked him like 2 years ago and I felt bad because, well, you know, it never happened. or it took this, from his perspective, it probably just never happened. So he probably thought I was blowing him off, but I was just trying to get the thing off the ground and I didn't want to waste his time. So we finally made it happen. And I'm so happy because he is a natural storyteller in just the way we converse and connect. And I think you'll really enjoy the stories and his own journey in our conversation that we had. But I've been here in Boise, Idaho, and after the Ram Dass release, I had a little bit of downtime, and I was using that to work on a music studio here in Boise, in the back of Radha's place. She's got this exterior garage, and I thought I would convert it. And I like to build. You know, I like to build as like a way of sort of soothing my mind and my soul, because it's like, it's sort of the opposite of anything digital. You're doing something very physical and cutting things, and it's numbers, but it's creative, and then you can see this thing taking shape in front of you. So I've just been hammering away at that, pun intended. Actually, I'm not very good with a hammer, but you know, nail guns and all sorts of things that you do with construction. And I'm really just trying to make a room for listening, you know, a room for critical mixing. Because you can do a lot on a laptop and with headphones these days, but usually for that last bit of a mix, you really need to be in a proper listening room. So you do all this work just to, I mean, I haven't even gotten to the stage of putting up like acoustical treatments. I was just trying to do things like drywall and insulation and electrical to get this garage basically into living space. Long story short, I've been busting my ass on this and it's been a fun challenge, but working really, really hard. Because I had a little window, and I was like, I want to use this window. I want to use this time before I hit the road again and head down to Boulder for the retreat coming up. And I was almost finished. I'm actually was in there painting. I had rented a paint sprayer from Home Depot, and I'm in there totally covered in one of those Tyvek suits that covers your head and your whole body, sweating balls. I mean, it's a complete sweatsuit because it was like 100 degrees outside. And I hear the dogs barking and this guy comes to the door and I go all the way to the front door and it's a city inspector giving me a stop work order and shutting the whole project down because some neighbor complained and I didn't have a certain permit that I didn't know I needed for something and blah, blah, blah. And it's opened this big can of worms where like, basically I don't even know how to move forward now. Like I have to redo things I've done, but I already finished the walls and I take responsibility for some of that. I could have done better research, but I was just plowing ahead because I just wanted to do things and wanted to feel busy and I was just enjoying. I knew how to do it, so I just wanted to just do it. And it's in the back, you know, by an alley. I thought I'm just essentially making a fancy converted garage and the city said no bueno. So to be honest with you, I have been losing some sleep over that. I went down to the city permitting office and was sort of just being like, what do I do? And they're working with me, but it's so much red tape. You know, and this house is in an area of town in Boise that's like the historic neighborhood. So you have to get permission to change the paint color on the outside. You have to get permission, you know, what kind of trim you want to use around the windows. And not just say, hey, I want to put some white trim up. No, no, no. You have to give them a site plan and a floor plan and elevations and photos and affidavits of ownership that are notarized. I mean, that's just to get permission to do anything. And that's if they say it is appropriate, a certificate of appropriateness. Needless to say, for my personality, that's really hard for me. I don't like being told what to do. And certainly, I don't own the house. Rada does. But, you know, you own a house, you want to feel like you can work on it. You can do stuff. But I'm all for code. Code is there for things to be safe. But this other level of, like, things being appropriate. So you can probably hear my ire. But we will work things out. We will figure out a way to get through this mess. It's just going to delay things significantly and add, unfortunately, a lot more cost. I was doing a lot of work to keep this on a budget. But thankfully, we've got the studio down in Boulder, Utah. And I'm going to be heading down there soon because the East Forest Retreat's coming up. And we had a little shuffling, as normally happens as we get closer to it, where a couple people couldn't make it anymore. So we've had a little bit of housing come up available. So check it out, eastforest.org/retreat, and see if maybe something's going to work there for you. It's a cool time of year to camp too, if you want to come down. When I first went to Boulder, Utah in 2008, I went for a retreat sort of like this. It was the Reality Sandwich Retreat, and I camped. And it was, now I live there. I'm not saying, you know, you're going to move there, but it changed my life. This retreat is mostly about the place. It's about that land, and it's about us gathering there and working with the energy of that land, because it is one of the most spiritual and profound places I've ever been on the planet, and that's why I live there. And so I want to invite you out. If you're feeling the call, check it out. It's coming up September 26th through 29th in Boulder, Utah, and that's all at eastforest.org. But first, I'm heading down to, just to let you know, I'm heading down to Austin, Texas on Monday, because I got connected with Aubrey Marcus, who's got a podcast of his own. It's got a nice audience, listenership, and he's a cool guy. And we were talking, and I was telling him about the Ram Dass record and how, you know, we're trying to get a Grammy in the New Age category for Ram Dass at 88 years old. And Aubrey's has really been into the record, so he said, why don't you come on the podcast, his podcast. But he only does it in person, so I'm heading down to Austin to just be on his podcast, which is pretty awesome. But I have some good friends there, David and Bree. We're definitely going to get some barbecue. I'm definitely going to swim in the thing they have there. So when this podcast comes out, I will be there, actually recording it on the day this comes out. And then I come back, and then Rod and I bounce out to Vancouver, British Columbia for the Vancouver Film Festival, where I'm going to be doing an East Forest Ceremony concert right before they do a screening and a premiere of Becoming Nobody, which is the new documentary about Ram Dass. And that is something you can get tickets to. So just go over to my website, and there's links and stuff, eastforest.org/tour, and you should be able to see stuff about Vancouver. And then soon I'll be in Burlington, Vermont in September, and the Love Yoga Fest in Cape Cod, Massachusetts. So hope to see you on the road. All right, let's get into this conversation with my good friend, Christopher Shin. Christopher Shin, it's been so long. I'm so happy that we're connecting again.
Yeah, I was trying to remember exactly how long. What year did you move out of New York City?
I think it was 2010.
Okay. We met in 2002, so we've known each other for 17 years.
Wow, that's awesome.
Yeah.
It's you know, people who are old friends, the value of them goes up and up like a good wine, because we witnessed one another at a different point in our lives. You can't go out and get that somewhere else. Like, I really honor the fact that you knew me when I was young, and I knew you when you were pretty young.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I agree. You know, there's something about experience that cannot be fully communicated down the line, you know, when you're meeting people later in life, trying to tell them who you were, what you were like. I mean, there's something just so special about having been through experiences with people and knowing that they saw you, you know, in real space and time at a certain point in your life. So, yeah, I mean, I think of myself as kind of old at that point because my dad was, I guess you probably met me right after my dad died. He'd been really sick and he died in late January. And I guess for those listening, I met Trevor because he was the understudy for two parts in, in my first big play in New York City. And so I think it was probably around, I think, you know, we cast the understudy around the time of opening. So probably when you met me, my dad had, you know, literally just died a few weeks before. So you were meeting me, even though I was kind of young and 26, at a time of, you know, significant psychic turmoil and grief. And,
I don't know if I knew that, because obviously it's not something maybe that comes out in conversation when you first meet someone. And we were just kind of getting to know each other when I first joined on at that play.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah. That was way, so that was probably 2000. What year was that? 2002?
That was early. Yeah. It was the play opened in February 2002. And so I remember you at the opening night. So you'd been hired, you know, at some point a week or two before then. We would have met in sometime in early February 2002.
I still have very vivid memories of that play. I remember the audition vividly. Like, I remember you sitting there, and I remember me trying to pretend I could bounce a basketball in the audition.
Yeah.
I remember everything. I remember the rehearsals. I remember going on. I remember all the people. Yeah, it was great.
Yeah, I remember you going on, which is pretty rare. It's rare that an understudy goes on. And I remember quite vividly watching you and how exciting that was.
It was like the first job I had, kind of. And I remember many years later, like 9 years later, one of the last jobs I had in New York before I left was understudying again at MTC for John Patrick Shanley's, what was it called? Defiance.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Never went on.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's been a long time.
Yeah, it has been.
Been a long time. And I have a lot of fond memories of us. You know, we're both in our 40s now. And so I'm thinking about when we were in our 20s in New York City. I guess I romanticized that a bit. But I was living for a minute there in Soho. And I remember we used to... And are you still on the Lower East Side?
I'm not. I moved out of there in 2012, but I did live there for 15 years.
Yeah.
But yeah, I remember when you lived in Soho. I feel like I helped you move. Even.
You did. I can't believe you remembered that on your message the other day, because I kind of forgot. I was like, oh my God, that's a different echelon of friend. Yeah, you helped me move out of that tiny postage stamp size Soho apartment that I was sharing with a friend.
Yeah. No, I remember sitting on the floor in that apartment and talking and... So, you know, I mean, you were always very philosophical. I feel like from the beginning we were having, I'm sure you've grown, you know, in immense ways since then, but we were having very philosophical discussions about happiness. And
were we?
Yeah.
I'm glad to hear that, because I think back on myself as like a punk a bit, but I'm glad to know at least we were still talking about somewhat meaningful things. I remember you that way, of course.
Yeah.
I remember arguing about the book Feeling Good.
Well, I have a bit. Yeah, that was a different apartment. You had moved to what? You'd moved uptown, or where were you?
Dumbo. I moved to Dumbo, and I was there forever. Yeah,
I remember that apartment well, and I remember Feeling Good on your bookshelf and arguing with you about it.
Well, this is what I remember about Feeling Good is that you told me initially, you're like, I checked it out, and you read a story in it. I don't remember the author's name. I'll have to look it up, but I apologize for not. The book Feeling Good, which is sort of a cognitive behavioral psychology, a book that's sort of meant for the layman to get into that world. And there was a story about a guy who loses a leg or an arm or something. And this is way back when you read this.
Yeah.
And the story was something like, well, he needs to think about it differently and use cognitive behavioral therapy so he's not so depressed. And you said, it's bullshit. You're like, that's bullshit. This book is bullshit. And I was like, okay. And we argued a bit and let it go. And then months passed. And I guess you revisited the book And then you came back to me, you said, you know what? I was wrong. I think there's a lot of truth to this CBT stuff.
Okay, I repressed that. Interesting. If that last part really happened, I repressed that fully.
Yeah. And I have, this is my memory. And it's just coming to me now. Cause like, so Chris, when I left New York, you're going to have to fill in the blanks for me a bit. I know you went through some physical trauma, but I actually don't know a lot of the details about it. And I think it's relevant to this memory.
Yeah.
If you could fill me in, but then it'll help connect the dots in the story here.
That is amazing. And you know, there's all kinds of strange references to being an amputee in my life, in my work, and this anecdote you just gave well before I became one. But basically, it was in, I guess, the summer of 2012. I used to run every day, and I noticed there was some numbness on my heel. And I kind of thought, oh, I need new running shoes. I run outside too much. I was about to move with my then fiance. We were moving from the Lower East Side to the Upper West Side. So it was also like a very chaotic, hectic time. And we had planned this vacation with my old roommate and his wife. So we were about to go to France for a couple weeks. And so I was like, well, I'm not going to worry about it too much. But, you know, there was just this kind of, you know, very, very subtle numbness on my left heel. And then I guess probably midway through this trip in July 2012 in France, we were in Beaune. I was running in a vineyard and I came down, you know, on my run. I came down on my left foot and I just felt excruciating shooting pain, unlike any kind of pain I'd ever felt before. And I thought, well, that's not good. And kind of hobbled home and I thought, well, I'm in France. There's really nothing I can do. And sort of the way it was like, if I started walking on it, it would be excruciatingly painful. But if I kept moving, I sort of got into a rhythm and the pain sort of plateaued and it was fine. So it was really just when I would get up that it would really hurt. And then I noticed this kind of lump in my ankle. And I thought, oh, you know, I just some kind of running injury. It's swollen. Got back to New York and immediately had to move. And, you know, moving is psychologically very stressful and brings up all kinds of feelings, memories,
and
trauma.
It's a whole nother level.
And I thought, man, it is a whole nother level in New York. And I was like, well, you know, this is probably, I probably like am dealing with immense stress and that's contributing to the pain in my foot. And, you know, I'm kind of be chill about it. I'll deal with it after we move. And we moved and this lump was still there and you know, the pain kind of went away, but I thought this is, you know, something I guess I'd have to deal with because the lump isn't going anywhere. And found a doctor, an orthopedist, and, you know, they were like, yeah, you have plantar fasciitis and you have a blister. It's just filled up with fluid and we can drain it for you and give you some cortisone. And they did that, and the cortisone erased any pain whatsoever. And I was like, all right, I guess I have this blister or whatever in my foot. And then I noticed that, like, the lump didn't go away. And I went back, and they said, oh, yeah, the blister's filled up again. You know, we'll give you some more cortisone, and we'll drain the blister again. Yeah, so they're, you know, jabbing a needle into what would turn out to be a malignant tumor.
Oh, my God. So
basically, when the lump didn't go away, they said, well, we should do an MRI. And then I think I was in Boston doing a play at this point, and I got this message from the doctor saying, you need to come in right away. We need to make sure we can save your foot. And that was a jarring message to receive, certainly not a message that should have been left in a voicemail. But you know, at that point, I still felt, you know, like, okay, you know, that's scary, but let's get this thing out of there. So I went and they kind of moved me up the chain to a more senior orthopedist. And he was like, yeah, you know, it's a tumor. I'm sure it's benign. It's probably benign, but let's do a biopsy. This is also really strange. I hear the word biopsy. I think, you know, you stick a little needle in, you get some tissue, whatever. So I kind of show up for this biopsy at a hospital. And, you know, I'm getting prepared for anesthesia and
oh my God,
to have surgery. And I was like, what is happening? Nobody told. I mean, I had literally no idea. You know, I learned pretty fast. It was a surgical biopsy, and had it done, woke up. You know, they told me I was going to be able to walk home. I could not even stand. And they, you know, there was at that point no doctors or anybody there that, you know, had done the surgery. So, you know, some nurse gave me some crutches and taught me how to use them. And said,
it's a big deal in New York City, too. Like, you know, not being able to walk.
Yeah.
So it's way different than your average city.
Yeah. My whole life was walking. I mean, I would walk everywhere. So I kind of, you know, got home on these crutches, and I guess, you know, in the back of my mind, after the surgery, you know, somebody come up to me and said, we got 70% of it. And I thought, oh, well, again, I thought a biopsy was just like a little, you take a little tissue. So I was confused. And it was like just a lot of terrible communication and, you know, emotional ineptitude, but I still didn't, I don't know. I didn't think I had cancer, but then the doctor called a couple of days later and just started rattling again with very little psychological sophistication or care, just started rattling off some very scary words. And I knew, okay, this is serious. This is really serious stuff. And he gave me a referral to a orthopedic oncologist at Memorial Sloan Kettering. And, you know, at that point it was like, all right, I have cancer. I've just been told I have cancer. And basically what happened, I mean, I didn't really know anything about it. I was warned, you know, don't Google, wait till you get to the doctor, you know, won't do any good to try to figure out what's going on your own. So I waited. I got into the system at Sloan Kettering, and I had this kind of magical doctor who sort of got me going there. And she was just immensely empathetic and precise, and it was, I remember her with such fondness and very, very vividly. And, you know, she explained to me I had this cancer that was probably Ewing's sarcoma. And what was unusual about it was that it's a pediatric cancer. And I think something like 90% of people who get it are under the age of 20. And I was 37 or 38, you know, when I got it. And she said, so, well, let me tell you what you can do. You can go to the adult sarcoma unit in this hospital, or you can go to the pediatric ward where you have the best doctors and the best nurses in the world.
That's so strange.
And I said, well, you know, you've laid it out pretty clearly. I'm going to go to pediatrics. So I went and I met my team there, and, you know, essentially, you know, they told me that, yes, I had a cancer that is classified as a pediatric cancer. And it required a very severe, harsh treatment. I mean, it was something, I don't know if they used those words, but they made it clear that it was, you know, a very long treatment road ahead. And they made it clear you're probably going to have your leg amputated. And so basically I started treatment. You know, I was very driven to be treated, to do it, to endure it, to do what I could to make it go as well as I could make it go. The chemotherapy was incredibly harsh. When I think back to it, I find it, I can't believe I got through it. It was a real lesson that you can get through things that actually, you know, in significant ways are close to impossible. Yeah. And after about three rounds of chemo, after about 9 weeks, they did some more x-rays and they said, yes, you will have to have your leg amputated. And so I had the surgery to amputate my left leg below the knee. And you know what, to detour for a second into that story, I think what's interesting is I don't know that I used any cognitive behavioral techniques necessarily. Although, you know, maybe some a little bit, and telling myself, you know, it's, my life will be fine. The important thing is to be alive and stuff like that. But what I did do, I think what was one of the decisive decisions I made was I really, before the surgery, I really mourned my lower leg and my foot. Like, I touched it a lot. I talked to it. I looked at it. I thanked it. I told myself, you know, thank you for being there for me for so many years. And, you know, like I really went through a process of, you know, of what you would go through in any significant loss of grief and mourning. And,
wow.
So I really took it seriously, you know, like I'm saying goodbye to a part of me forever. And I donated the tumor to research so they could, you know, research the cancer and possible treatments. So, you know, I was really losing it, you know, completely. And then my treatment took a turn, I guess, maybe 3 or 4 months after that. And this was really probably the low point. They did some scans and they discovered that, although they had felt that the amputation and the continued chemotherapy, you know, would lead to my being in a state of health, they found the cancer had spread. It was in my lungs.
Is it after the surgery?
Well, what they said was cancer is a bit like, the doctor said to me, imagine taking a handful of sugar and throwing it on the beach. And then we tell you to go get all the little grains of sugar, you know, that there's cancer cells in your body that, you know, we can't see, we can't measure. So all the scans up to that point had been really good, but it's not like these scans are able to capture, you know, every individual cell in your body. So essentially I had cancer the whole time. The treatment never worked, never fully worked. And it just appeared that it did. So at that point, it was quite bleak. I mean, they essentially, I felt like I was being treated like I was going to die. And, you know, I remember asking about treatment options and they talked about a few. And at the end they said, and the other option is to, you know, to end treatment. Oh, and I thought, wow, that's
an option. Yeah.
That is an option. That is terrifying to me. And it was, you know, it was horrific. I mean, it was shocking. It was very, 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 very upsetting. But I kind of, at that point, I think is when I did really start Googling. And I was like, all right, now I need to learn. And I found out that the survival rate for someone in my situation at that point was 7%, survived 5 years. So, you know, to me, I thought, well, that's not a terminal diagnosis to me. That's telling me that 7 out of 100 people will live. So let me think that, you know, maybe I'll be one of these 7 people. I mean, now that thought came with all kinds of endless terror and anxiety and sadness. But I still did think very deeply that I didn't want to die. I felt like I want to live and let me do what I can to maximize my chances. So I remember coming home from the doctor that day and I used to have cats and the oldest cat kind of jumped up on my chest and put her paws over my lungs, which I thought was amazing. Just looked at me and started purring. And it's a very precious memory of this, you know, beloved animal who, you know, recognized me even when I lost all my hair and lost part of my body. And, you know, I kind of determined that day, like, you know, I'm going to really, really try to stay positive despite all my fear. And I had another, a different chemotherapy. I think it was, I don't know, maybe 9 or 10 more rounds. And I did whole lung radiation.
Wow.
I started seeing an acupuncturist. I started doing Chinese herbs. You know, I really started to take my life. I mean, I always took my life seriously, but I really looked at it as a job to do everything I could to maximize my chances of living. And then I joined a clinical trial at the National Institute of Health, which basically I just kind of did research endlessly to see if there was any kind of further treatment I could undergo. And I found this trial where essentially a doctor was experimenting with immunotherapy and basically was creating a vaccine that was designed to interrupt or interfere with a certain protein that I guess is present in cancers that travel to the lungs. So I guess I'm really a layman, so anything I say about science, take with a grain of salt. But my understanding was what they hoped that the vaccine would accomplish was that if it encountered the cancer cells, instead of those cancer cells attaching to the lungs, they would slip off. I mean, it would literally just prevent them from attaching and growing. So I did this trial down in Bethesda, Maryland, for maybe 6 months. And that was when my treatment ended, I guess, in May 2015. So, you know, I'm still here. I've marched past that 5 year mark. I've been healthy ever since I stopped my treatment, my main treatment, which ended in the spring of 2014. So, you know, I count myself very lucky. I think probably more than anything, what happened was luck. And I think of the people I know who had what I had, who died, who, you know, were just as beautiful and soulful and artistic and creative.
Yes.
And in love with life as I was, you know, who didn't make it. So, you know, I think I just got lucky.
Let me ask you about luck, if you don't mind.
Yeah.
So I heard you say, thank you for sharing that story, by the way. It's helpful for me, but I think it's one of personal fire. And that's something universal to the human journey. That's like, we all kind of go through these things in different ways at different times in our lives. Maybe not to that severity, but nonetheless, it happens. And it's important to hear about. But you were mentioning before you started that there was sort of like signposts or echoes in a way about amputation in your life that preceded this. And
well, I had
does that have meaning for you in any way beyond, you know, when I hear the word luck, I think chance, I think sort of like, yeah, this is how it is. You know, sometimes things happen and that's that, as opposed to, it's natural for us as humans to try to find meaning in this. And I always go that direction. It's sort of like the soul's journey. And I think about, you know, karma and things like that. But did any of that come up for you when you look back, when you look at sort of these illuminations of your future coming to you?
I think what is interesting, I mean, I remember very vividly the first amputee I got to know. I was living on Lower East Side, and my neighbor, suddenly I hadn't seen him in a while, and then I saw that he had a prosthesis, and he knocked on my door in the winter. It would ask me to go down and buy cigarettes and for him, and it was hard for him to get around, and especially when it was snowy or icy out. And I we just became sort of fascinated, you know, with how he was managing. I kind of noticed what was going on in his apartment, and I saw that, you know, his son seemed to have moved into some kind of criminal activity, given the number of people who were over and number of people coming by the apartment very briefly and leaving. I thought there must be some kind of drug dealing happening, and it was all new. It was as if the situation that had produced the amputation had unsettled the whole apartment. Things were quite chaotic, and I learned later that he had a car accident, and that's how he lost his leg. And I just had a tremendous amount of affection for him. He was my neighbor, and a very sweet man. Every once in a while, I'd be a bit annoyed. I would feel he was, you know, asking a little too much of me, but I, you know, always tried to help him out. And the person I was dating at the time, he really objected to this, and he said that I was becoming a caretaker and I was being, you know, taken advantage of. And I remember my heart sinking. I remember thinking, just intuitively, that someone you're in love with, you don't want to hear them trivializing someone's emotional needs. I mean, this person had, you know, lost their leg in a traumatic accident, and seeing them as needy and manipulative, you know, it's one way to look at it. You could also look at it as a human being who is lonely, who wants contact, doesn't know how to emotionally engage, and asking his neighbor to buy cigarettes is one way that, you know, he feels that he's in a world of care and human contact. And so I wrote this play called Where Do We Live, which was basically my attempt to understand what was happening in my life around that time. Dating somebody who I was madly in love with, who actually wasn't a very compassionate person, trying to understand why would I love somebody who was like that. and exploring the life of my neighbor. So I wrote this character who was an amputee. So in one of my favorite plays, one of the major characters is an amputee. And that's probably the biggest example. But, you know, I wrote other things where I would have amputees and, you know, TV shows that never got made and things like that. But I think that experience of seeing my neighbor, you know, go through a trauma and have to adapt and the incredible struggles, because he was somebody, you know, this is a building that was gentrifying, but he had been there forever. He was Dominican and, you know, they were paying very low rent. So, you know, watching somebody in a rapidly gentrifying neighborhood, a building that's changing, where I'm sure that, you know, they wished those people would move out so they could put someone like me in the apartment. You know, it just awakened me, I think, to, you know, suffering and the challenges of living when unexpected traumas happen. So, you know, I think I was prepared in a sense, you know, and I think my dad dying too had something to do with that, that I realized, okay, bad things can happen and you have to keep living. And so life, the meaning of life can't just be, oh, things can be great and I just need to make my life amazing. You know, things happen that are nobody's fault, that are accidents, that you know, change your life in really challenging and painful ways, and you have to keep going. So I think, you know, and that experience was with the neighbor, that was 2001, right around, you know, right before we met, because it was around 9/11 as well. And yeah, I think after that, it just opened my eyes. And, you know, so amputees were maybe a more visible example of, you know, certain kinds of challenges. And so maybe that's why I was drawn to thinking about them. But yeah, when I became an amputee, I certainly looked back at that play and thought I was ready in part because I had thought about this. I had directed my attention to something that, you know, the guy that was dating at the time couldn't think about, didn't want to think about, or only wanted to think about as some kind of negative and, you know, some kind of a symbol of manipulation, irresponsibility.
It's amazing to me when you tell me this story. It's like, it's not like you just had a neighbor who was an amputee, but it's like you had this relationship that is very dramatic in a dramaturgical sense. It's like, and then you wrote a play about it, and then it's sort of like it became into your life. It's for myself, I like to think about like these major events in our lives and almost like how the event itself is echoing back into its prehistory in a way. You know, like it's so big in your life that its reverberation is coming into, like, it's going backwards in time. Even like the conversation we had, like, why would I remember that right now?
Yeah.
I do remember you saying it. We were on the street on Cleveland Place where we were walking outside and you were telling me this about the book. I have the image in my head. I don't know why I remember that.
Yeah.
But I feel like there's a reason. It's sort of like, to me, it connects dots about, it gives me some kind of solace about, meaning, as so things don't just feel random. Like when I broke my arm, I don't have the answers to why that happened twice and all this kind of stuff, but there's something in there that helps me feel a little better, because when things are just so unbelievably random in your mind, that's scary, because I don't know. It's just, you got so close to death, you know, and I would imagine that process, perhaps you could tell me, did that change your own relationship to death? Because I would assume then that would very much change your relationship to life and how you now have been living your life since then.
You know, I think that's a really good question. Let me preface it by briefly referring to something you just previously said. I do think there's a lot we don't know about time. I think there have to be realities to time that we're not consciously aware of, or we only maybe glimpse in brief moments of inspiration or our dream lives. And I don't think it's impossible that we have some awareness of our future selves, our future experiences. So it may be in some way that, you know, again, not that I knew in any sense that, oh, one day I'll be an amputee, so let me really pay attention to this amputee down the hall. But I don't think it's impossible that something resonated with a potential future. And that is part of what led me to attend to this area in life, you know, 15 years or a I guess just at that point, just a decade, you know, a decade before it's going right. to happen to me. So I think that is, there are, I think life, when it doesn't feel random, when it does feel like, wait, it feels like there's meaning, but it's hard to understand exactly how to articulate it or explain it. Sometimes I think maybe time, that meaning is derived from a much deeper reality about time that we don't fully grasp yet. I love in terms that. Of death, what I would say is, I want to be careful because I want to respect people who've actually died. And I tell myself often, whatever I experienced, it can't be the same. I remember early on that the doctor I first, the one I really liked that I mentioned early, who kind of got me into the system at Sloan Kettering, I remember asking her about numbers and percentages, because at that point I really wanted to know, like, what are my chances? And she said, the only numbers that matter are 0 and 100. You know, if I tell you you have 0 chance of living, you need to know that. If I tell you you're 100% sure to be fine, you should know that. Everything else, what does it get you? It's a number. It's abstract. It's not your experience. And you can't really extrapolate from it, which I think is very wise. So no one ever told me you're definitely going to die. It was the atmosphere change. You know, when I walked into my doctor's office, the nurse couldn't look at me, and there wasn't any joking for a few weeks, and everybody was very sad. But nobody ever said, you know, you're going to die. And, you know, the few experiences I had, you know, the chemotherapy at a certain point was so debilitating that literally just to sit up, you know, if I'm laying down and I told myself, okay, I want to sit up, I would be so tired and so weak. It might take me 15 or 20 minutes literally just to decide that I could try, that I didn't, you know, I didn't believe if I just tried to get up that I'd be able to do it. So I'd need to really think it through. And at one point I felt really bad, and I was actually at home because my fever hadn't reached the state where they tell you have to come into the hospital because they fear you have an infection. But I just had a bad feeling, and I called my doctor, and, you know, he said, all right, even though your temperature is not high enough to require it, you know, let's not risk it. Why not just come in? And by the time I got there, I started having overwhelming chills and vomiting, and I felt the worst I'd felt at any point in the treatment. The next day they told me that my red blood cells, the doctor said to me, they're not the lowest I've ever seen in somebody who wasn't dead, but they're close. They were close. And I thought, wow, okay, that's intense. Like, he's telling me that, you know, my biology was not that far from a dead person. And then it turned out I had E. coli. I did have an infection, which is why I had been feeling so bad.
Just throw that into the mix.
Yeah, I was there too. And so when I think back to how bad I felt, how sick I felt, how weak I felt, how tired I felt, I think, yes, there must be something in that experience that is like dying, that, you know, is somewhere on the continuum towards dying, and I can, you know, learn from it. But something always stops me, because I just think, if I had died, or, you know, if I had been told you're probably going to die soon, you know, I think just that would be a different experience. And I never felt I had that. I always sort of felt, I think I'm going to be okay, or I think I'm going to live, or I want to live. You know, at my bleakest, the thought was, I want to live, even if I thought I probably wouldn't. So I don't have that experience of someone saying, you are so sick and there's nothing we can do, and you're going to die at some point in the next whatever. So I just want to respect the people. I don't know what it's like to know you're going to die and then die. And when I think of the experiences of the people I know or knew who did that, who had that experience of being told they're going to die and then dying, as much as I feel like I can empathize and imagine, I just feel like there's some area of their experience I can't penetrate. And so I guess I think of it a little differently, like I went through something that made me realize how hard life can be, how much suffering there is in the world, that organizing your life around ambition, fame, pleasure, you know, these things that are very alluring, is silly, that there's a deeper meaning to life, and that the meaning is discovered more deeply in these times of real suffering. Because, you know, I think you just see very clearly that all these temporary pleasures, they're different than happiness. Pleasure and happiness are different things. And I had to find meaning in life for, you know, the really intense stretch of treatment from November 2012 to February 2014. I had to find meaning with almost no pleasure. I mean, very little that would be considered pleasurable. And, you know, I had a play that I'd written before I got sick that opened in that time. I got a really bad New York Times review. My fiance left me, announced the relationship was over between the 18th cycle of chemotherapy and my final cycle of chemotherapy, the 19th. So the person I thought I was going to marry, that, you know, that I loved, ended the relationship. I mean, it wasn't even just that I was sick. I was also going through career disappointments, profound romantic, intimate trauma. So I really was like, life, you cannot derive meaning from success, pleasure, being desired, you know, because you have to keep going even when all those things are taken away.
What kept you going? Because, you know, some people would be sort of the start of a certain depression where you're like, well, you know, where is the meaning?
Well, I think, you know, I was certainly depressed for a lot of it. I think maybe the meaning is in the belief that life is meaningful in itself. I think probably, you know, and that may sound quite abstract, but I experienced it in a very visceral way. That just the fact that life exists, that there is something rather than nothing, that somehow, like, we're here living, breathing, talking, thinking, feeling, that just has to have meaning in itself. And it made me, the experience made me respect life much more. I mean, not that I didn't before, but I just felt that this has meaning in itself, not meaning because what we can do with it, you know? And so wanting to live, I think, had a lot to do with just feeling like that there's something sacred about being alive and wanting to stay alive, you know, as long as I could. So that's how I'd say it.
I find that beautiful. I find it devoid of religion and almost spirituality, but yet at the same time, I find that statement very psychedelic, because this ineffable feeling in the deepest states I've ever experienced, I'm sure any of us have through trauma or change, is sort of that. It's like it can't be explained, but there is meaning. Like, it matters. And that kind of translates down to, like, even just like our thought process in our minds. Like, I sense in my body that it does matter. Like, it's not like I'm this isolated being and it's all sort of unimportant, but I can't explain why. But I do sense that there's like this connectedness, and it does matter. And like, just this notion of you are incarnate and alive, and all things that are alive, which is really everything around us. It's like, yeah, it's beyond us being able to say, oh, this has this value and this has that value. And I mean, you're a really brave soul to have gone through all that in without having something like religion or something else to kind of hold on to and tie those knots together. It's quite a journey. And I would imagine that in your own work as a playwright, I saw you say something in a video or an interview about honesty, awakening honesty. And I really like that phrase, because sort of like honesty being a fundamental, you know, truth that means something or matters. And, you know, you and I were talking on email a little bit about sort of creating that type of work, honest work, vulnerable work, and how this sort of stuff is represented in the shadows of a lot of creative arts, like the lesser arts, I think you were talking about. because it's maybe it's less valued by society, even though it's maybe the most important. But at the same time, we're both in a system that's, well, deeply capitalistic and problematic. Like, we're inside systems that are broken and trying to make work that's speaking to the sort of the most honest parts of ourselves and honest parts of our society. And that's something I think about all the time. And when you brought that up in the email, I was like, yeah, that's definitely something I'd like to talk about, because I'd like to hear how that comes up for you. When you talked about that New York Times criticism stuff, you know, I'm well aware of the power of the Times, especially with plays. But it speaks to like this broader conversation about criticism in general, and especially now how everyone's a critic and everything's quantified and everything's about data. It's a strange time in that way to be making art and to be being creative and having that be your sole expression, especially for people like us who are largely doing it in a way where we're trying to it to be very honest.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what your experience is. I feel like it's in many significant ways, it's getting way harder, that capitalism just becomes more and more the only language spoken. That everything is about the market. Everything is about numbers, data, as you say, like everything is quantified. And, you know, social media creates an atmosphere of hype, you know, where artists are hyping themselves, artist friends are hyping their work. Like it can feel like a time. I mean, you know, I know there's still meaningful things that succeed and break through and stuff, but it feels to me more than ever like the logic of the market is everywhere, and that sacred space outside of the market is shrinking more and more. So my feeling now is like, you know, if you create something that isn't immediately embraced by the establishment, the mainstream, the marketplace, it can kind of feel like it didn't happen. And it's like a really lonely and dangerous feeling, because I think you know, every once in a while I feel myself getting a little more narcissistic in some way. And I'll think, I feel what's happening. It's
because, like, as a form of protection, the narcissism in a sense.
Where I just feel like, oh man, like 2 years ago, I think I would have thought about this longer and deeper. And now I have an impulse to sort of shut down some more thoughtful and emotional part of myself, because all I see around me is, you know, superficial social media, you know, virtue signaling, bragging, self-promotion, where I feel like, oh, that's the energy like you need, and I should just embrace that energy. And then I feel like this deeper part of me is neglected. And part of me is like, no, go back to that deeper part of you. And then part of me is like, no, that doesn't help you. Like, you need to be in this capitalist world the way it is. Like, just shut that part of you off. And, you know, I mean, I think, you know, one of the things I always find very meaningful, and if this went away, I think I'd have a really hard time. But, you know, anything I've had has gotten bad reviews and, you know, hasn't sold well, or, you know, hasn't gone on to be produced other places. I always, with those plays, I still get beautiful emails where people talk about how much the play meant to them. And I, you know, I can feel like it really did mean something to them, that it reached them, you know, in a real way. They're not just writing me hoping, oh, you know, this guy will help my career. You know, they're often people who have no ties to the theater or entertainment industry. They just want to tell me, like, this really meant something to me. And
they're being honest.
And they don't care what the market said and the critics said and the establishment and whatever. And they don't care that, like, you know, I'm middle-aged now, 44 years old, and like, it's still, I know I see like younger writers and the kind of excitement and heat that's around younger people. And I think, wow, but, you know, it's like these things, all these superficial things that probably I benefited from, honestly, at some point in my career, you know, they've all kind of moved, shifted focus to others. And it's harder. It's harder to not have that narcissistic gratification of feeling like, oh, all right, I'm the cool one. I'm like the edgy one, I'm young, I'm sexy, I'm like whatever the kind of excitement was at one point. But, you know, I don't want to understate, you know, how hard it is, even though I recognize like, okay, this is just sort of the way that my industry has gone. and the natural inclination of a culture to move to what's young and new and fresh and exciting. I do find it, you know, really, really difficult, because it does feel like the world is so all encompassing now. It doesn't feel like there's an outside to me. Like, that's a friend of mine said it once, that it used to feel like there was an outside to culture. Not everything was sort of part of one thing. And again, this is sort of an abstract idea, but I feel like there's a real kind of practical grounded truth to it. Just like the way the internet works and social media and all of that, it can feel like you're either, you know, you're somewhere in this hierarchy that this world of media and social media creates. And, you know, if you're lower down, it can be really hard. You feel lonely, neglected, abandoned, you know, like you feel not listened to, not important or whatever. So, you know, to me, the challenge of this moment is in figuring out how can I make sure that I continue to value what I do and believe in it and maintain my integrity and my sense of truth and make enough money to keep going without necessarily being, you know, the cool kid or being, you know, at the top of this ladder or whatever. That's, I guess, the thing I find really challenging. You know, I think in my mind, like, you could have a world with so many artists doing all kinds of interesting things, and, you know, people could pick and choose, you know, who they like and who they want to follow. And it doesn't really feel that way to me anymore. It feels like everything is, you know, binary, kind of up, down, hot, not hot. Like, and so that, I think, is what I find really challenging about this era, where it feels like we're all in one kind of big, crazy virtual world. And it's hard to know exactly how to find emotional and practical sustenance when you're not being as desired as you might like to be.
Yeah, and you're doing it inside a medium. I mean, would you say that your primary medium is as playwright, as opposed to film or TV?
Yeah, I mean, I would like to work in film and TV more. I've never had anything made. There's a movie somebody did of one of my plays, but I wasn't involved in it. And nothing I've written for film or TV has ever been made. But I would like to work in film and TV. But yeah, until I actually succeed in getting something made for the screen, I think absolutely I identify as a playwright.
Yeah, I mean, where do you see that medium going, or the role it plays, its relevancy as a creative artistic expression as we're going forward? Because it's still around.
Yeah, you know, I mean, obviously. I think it's linked to what I was just saying, that, you know, when I was young, there was not all this content everywhere. You know, there was a lot of stuff, I guess. You know, you could go to the library and there'd still be thousands of books. But, you know, you were sort of limited by, you know, you would go to the record store, you'd buy a record or CD, you go turn on your TV, you have 40 channels, maybe 50 channels, you know. Our lives weren't consumed by content. Now there's, you know, however many millions of things to listen to, whatever streaming music service you use, there's 500 channels, and there's social media. You know, we carry around these computers in our pockets and we're online all the time. So I'm like, wow, my whole image of art when I was young was like, this is something that leads you into the world, and there's only so much to choose from. So when you find something, you can feel like a part of a community, like whoever else is that you know is listening to that album, or whoever else is at that play with you, or in the movie theater. It feels, I mean, you know, there's still albums we all listen to, and some TV shows, I guess, we all watch, but it feels much more like everybody has their own private, curated, you know, self-curated world of movies, TV, and books that you know, that are theirs out of the millions of things that they're choosing to listen to and watch and read. And so that kind of dream that I always had, that art was something that it comes from a place of kind of individual isolation, but then broadens into something that can help create a community, that it doesn't really feel that way anymore. It feels much more like the world is a very loose collection of individuals who all have their highly unique, idiosyncratic, very specific tastes. So I'm like, why? Yeah, what? You know, when I was a kid, I remember certain shows we'd all watch. And the beauty of that, like sitting down as a family to watch something. And that was always to me what art was, something that was done collectively, that tension between the individual and the collective. And so now I'm like, yeah, now it's more about you. Like you find your specific audience. And that's how all these channels are thinking, like, who's the audience for this? And they want big audiences, of course, but it's not that thing of like, there's only going to be 80 shows on the air. So, you know, there's only so much to choose from. Now I think my friend told me there's something like 420 new shows, not even counting like reruns and old shows and stuff. There's 420 shows a year on TV now. So yeah, that dream that like art is something that brings together a community, that's kind of gone away. And so it's changed like how I think of it. Like, well, what would a movie or a TV show do today? You know, theater has always been marginal. So I guess I've always sort of thought of that as, you know, something that, okay, you'll have a limited audience, at least initially. And then maybe people around the country will read your play or something. But I always thought of film and TV as uniting people. And like, yeah, it's rare now that you feel that kind of like collective engagement around a film or a TV show.
I mean, a lot of your work, the way it's sort of creating a collective is sort of by exploring a tension or a darkness or a trauma, in a sense, would you say?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I think that's probably what I feel, at least one of the things art can do the best, right? Can create a way of thinking about things that are hard to think about. That's somewhat less direct, less immediately frightening and traumatizing. You know, the story and character, you know, can deliver you more deeply into an experience and kind of prepare you to get there, as opposed to just jumping in and thinking about something that's really, really hard to think about. And so, yeah, I think what I've always used my writing to do is to kind of create that environment where people can think about difficult things that are a part of life. And again, it gets back to capitalism and how dominant capitalism has become and how we think about literally everything. And, you know, capitalism and thinking about difficult things don't necessarily, you know, go well together. My partner had never seen the Sopranos, so just finished. So I kind of watched the last season of Sopranos with them. And, you know, I was like, this show is profound in many ways. It's incredibly insightful about a certain kind of BS that Americans are fond of, and denial of their true selves and their actual motivations and all this stuff. But there's also just a lot of sex and violence. You know, there's a lot of candy. There's a lot of superficiality. You know, I think it is really hard to create deep work that asks you to think about difficult things. And it's hard for me because I don't want to put the candy in there. Not that I'm against pleasure or anything, but I just sort of feel like, you know, I want to honor the complexity and reality of life at every moment of what I write. And the idea that, well, there's like 70% of the audience is superficial and is just going to want a lot of blood and guts and sex. So let me put a bunch of that in there. It's just really hard for me to do. And I think I've never really been able to do it.
No, but you tend to go another direction where I'd say you very bravely go directions that make sometimes people uncomfortable. And that's the opposite energy that I think other writers perhaps would avoid. I mean, I remember when we were doing Four, you know, every now and then there'd be someone who'd walk out because it challenged them in a way. And that's kind of rare in a play. If you think about it, you're in a play with other people and you're deciding you're going to be noticed. And you're deciding like, I have to leave because this is too much for me to think about or watch. That's bold.
Yeah. Yeah.
I haven't seen in person many of your other plays, but I know about some of them, and I'm guessing you go to those edges.
Yeah, the people walk out a lot. I just had a revival of a play called Dying. What? Yeah, yeah. I think this revival I had in my play Dying City we did a couple months ago in New York. I think at least a few walkouts per week. I remember Googling. I had this play called Against in London. And I, you know, when you have a play in another city, you know, you go home after it opens, you don't get to see it. I don't know. I was Googling to see what people were saying. And somebody wrote, they felt really bad for the actors because after the intermission, 50 people had left.
Oh, my God.
And I don't know. They could have been exaggerating. It's the world of the internet. But, you know, it's again, it's like that. From the market perspective, that's a disaster, right? Like from a market perspective, that means like people are like, no, I don't want this. This sucks. But from an artistic perspective, it could mean that actually the work is doing something really important, that it's bringing up difficult, painful subjects in a way that some people are like, I'm not going to look at this. You know, I refuse to look at this. So that conflict I feel, I mean, you know, now that I'm older and like having gone through what I went through, it's like, I'd like to have some money in the bank. You know, sometimes disasters hit and life gets hard and, you know, it's easier to deal with trauma when you're not worried about, you know, getting kicked out of your apartment. So there's that part of me that's like, you need to figure out more how to do what you do, but to merge it with more audience pleasing storytelling.
God, that tension though is such a slippery slope. I feel it too. You know, I never want to feel I'm pandering. I also never want to, you know, or I don't want to make art out of that mindset. And I wouldn't consider my work particularly edgy in an overt sense at all. I mean, it's quite like soothing. But I like when I was making the album with Ram Dass, I wasn't saying, hey, I want to make something that's provocative. Like that's my mindset. But I also was saying, if I'm not sort of rubbing the old guard with some friction here, I'm probably not doing a very good job because I want this to reach new ears. I want to connect with like a new audience for him. That was sort of like my mission with it. And it is a slippery slope when you're actually creating. And you're trying to come from that place of honesty we were talking about before, but doing it in a way that is balancing all these different things. When you're doing it as a career, as a job, just like you said, you're like, but I need it. I want it to be a success because I'd like to pay my rent and I'd like to be able to make a little money and I'd like to do more work and have more resources. Do you find that that's a kind of like a conversation in your mind at all, or you just let it go?
I mean, I think what I would say to, I mean, I don't know that I would actually say this to my students today, but I've thought about saying it. What I would think about saying is maybe think of your art as a hobby rather than the thing you're going to make money from and get a job that isn't connected to your artistic practice because then you can keep your art pure. And hey, maybe you'll get really lucky and make a ton of money on something that, you know, is totally your vision without any, you know, compromises, but that's pretty rare. And it's immensely painful to start making compromises to your work in order to make money. And, you know, because it's getting harder and harder, I think, to resist that logic of the market, logic of capitalism, I think it's becoming, you know, less and less advisable to choose the arts as a career. It feels to me like thinking of them as a really serious hobby might be better in the long term. Because, you know, I kind of feel like I'm a bit too old maybe to change what I do. Although I've been, you know, thinking about that too. Like, could I actually kind of create another life for myself? You know, maybe one thing being so sick made me feel was I don't want to waste any time. Like, you never know how long you're going to be alive, and I want my life to be as meaningful as possible. So, you know, the idea that I'm going to waste a lot of time trying to, you know, I realize when I go into meetings in Hollywood, like whatever else they're thinking, they're also thinking, will this idea be popular? Will it make money? And it had like never occurred to me before that, like, on a just a very basic level, it's like, will this make money? I never think that. I'm never like, will this idea make money? And I realized, like, actually,
is it a good business?
Yeah. Is this a good business move? Business
plan of your play. Yeah.
So, you know, I think sometimes too, like, could I have some kind of different life and writing would become something I continue to do, but I don't think of it as like, this is my way to make money. Because I do think the logic of the market, the logic of capitalism. Look, I feel the same about human relationships too. I think people are treating each other more and more like objects. They're treating themselves more and more like products. Like, it's the ideology of the market is infecting every aspect of life. And if you're not careful, you know what I was saying before about sometimes feeling like I'm becoming a little more narcissistic, I think it's like it can really easily overtake your psyche where you're like, all right, I'm a product and I have to sell myself. And let me look around at this room of products and decide what products I want to align myself with. How many followers do these people have? And how many followers do I have? You know, where everything is data and you're quantifying and objectifying self and others. Like, it's a really intense time. And like, preserving love outside of market ideology, preserving art outside of market ideology, I think it's really, really challenging. And it's nothing, I don't think there's any easy answers or solutions to it.
Well, you have amputated social media from your life, have you not?
Yes. I am about to do a fellowship at Harvard for 4 months. And I thought, if I even just use my phone 2 hours less a day, that's 14 hours a week. That's probably 2 books. So, you know, I could read 8 more books a month for 4 months. It's over 30 books. Like, that's a no-brainer. Just like, how could I give up that opportunity? You know, because I'll be away from my environment. I'll really be able to focus. And,
are you going to be living out there?
I'll be living in Cambridge for 4 months. So I'll be out of my environment, which, you know, can allow for new rituals and new rhythms and stuff. And
what time of year?
It's going to be this fall. So the September to December 31st. So it's
that's perfect. That's the best time there.
Definitely the best time. So excited about it. So yeah, I'm off. You know, I did reactivate my Twitter. I deleted all my tweets and deleted everything because I had a insurance denial for a piece of equipment in my prosthesis that I really need. And I just sort of thought, you know what, like, in case I need to like fight an insurance company and use my social media leverage, maybe I should just keep the account alive in case I ever need to use it. So I did reactivate it, but I'm not using it. And I got rid of my Instagram. So yeah, I'm trying that. I mean, I think I, you know, it's not just because I wanted to read more books in Cambridge. It was also a feeling of, I feel like I'm objectifying myself. Others are objectifying themselves. And I feel like a lot of my friendships aren't actually friendships. In fact, the only way I'll know if they're really friendships is if I go off all this stuff and my my real friends are going to be the ones who stay in touch and we continue to have a real friendship. So yeah, I don't know any really good answers to how we resist the marketization of literally everything, but I'm trying. I'm really trying to resist it and trying new tactics, you know, to just preserve a little space of, you know, authentic human emotion and relationship outside of that capitalist ideology.
Hey, when you're doing your fellowship, is that with the ART at all?
It isn't. Is that where you went to school?
Yeah, for grad school.
That's what I thought. I mean, I just remembered it as soon as you said that. No, it's not connected to the ART. But I'm kind of hoping to like knock on their door and say hello for sure.
Yeah. I'm trying to think who's still there. I don't even know who the artistic director is anymore, but, definitely go over there. Yeah. Say hi to whoever's in charge. Well, let me just ask you, about something you said before. You were just saying that you wanted to sort of, that life is not that long and you sort of recognize that and you wanted to stick with what was really important. And I'm just curious, what is important to you? Like, what are those things that you find is more valuable?
You know, I think really the thing I keep coming back to recently is intimacy. I mean, I know that like life is more than relationships, and certainly given all the political and social trauma all around the world, you know, that these are things that need to be addressed. But you know, I'm just one person, and I tend to think more on the individual level in terms of, you know, how I can contribute to meaning, in the world in general and in the lives of people I know. And I feel like intimacy, I mean, it's the one thing I think, you know, we can all be activists to some extent. We can try to participate in larger movements, but you know, the one thing we all do is we all have relationships with other people. And so trying to be good at them, I think is really, really important. And I feel like the danger of the times we're living in is that it's getting easier to dissociate and to, you know, to sort of not be present, right? Because we have so many things that can take us away from what we're feeling and do a good job at it too. You know, I mean, you can really be going through something difficult and then just scrolling through, you know, the internet on your phone can, in a kind of manic way, really distract you successfully for a long time. But I feel like intimacy is so important because, you know, to know how you feel and feel you can say it to someone else, I think if that's lost, if that really becomes lost, then anything can happen. I mean, any kind of disaster, politically, socially, I mean, I think that is the foundation for a heartless world, a violent world, where, you know, the only hope for any kind of collective action is if, you know, people remain alive to their vulnerable selves, remain alive to the truth, remain alive to how they feel. And I think to be able to do that, you need other people that you can really communicate with. So that's the thing I think I'm most afraid of going away in the world, but you know, also in myself, that it's hard. It's hard to stay in touch with your vulnerability, with your trauma, with, you know, the full complexity of your emotional life. And, you know, we're all working so hard and we're all stressed and, you know, it can be hard to stay open to others. So that to me feels like something that is really, really important, that I stay in touch with how I feel and that I find a way to communicate it to the people I really care about and care for, so that they know me, you know, so that I'm not pretending, I'm not acting, I'm not performing, but that I'm really, you know, as much as it's humanly possible, I'm being myself and being honest.
Honesty, awakening, honesty.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's awesome. I really feel that that's a great perspective, and that our relationships, the ones we have, the actual, you know, physical relationships, intimate relationships, it's the crucible for our soul, and it's the real grist for the mill. And it's, I think, where besides the relationship in our own mind with ourself and our heart, that's kind of where the rubber meets the road. So I resonate with that too, man.
And it's where I think we see, you know, how much more there is to do, you know, that we all fail in intimacy, you know, that we're all imperfect and that we can always get better at it. Get better at knowing ourselves, get better at listening to others and communicating, and you know, that it's a practice. It's a really practical practice to get better at love. No one is perfect at it. It's one of those things that everybody struggles with. Intimacy is hard for literally everybody. And I think that, you know, that's why I feel like it's such an important area, for humanity. You know, it is a real human universal. We all deal with other people intimately. And to figure out how to be better at that, I think is just, immensely important.
Yeah, and thank God it's not quantified like everything else. I mean, that's what makes it so real in the ground floor of our human experience, is that I can't tell you that I'm at a 73 out of 100 on my love quotient, and I'm gonna get it up. And you know, I'm doing better. It's like, you're just, it's a journey and it's not linear. And, it's meant to be challenging. Of course it is. Like, why else wouldn't it be? It's like, even if you took the perspective of you came here to do some work, it's like, well, of course the work's going to be work. Otherwise there's no work. Otherwise you'd just be floating around like little tubbies and we're just in this blissful state all the time. That's not what it seems like any of this is about. It's clearly about, friction. And that way, you know, where you've been and where you're going and what accomplishes you've made. And, there's growth essentially.
Yeah.
And everything on this planet is about growth, right? Everything grows and dies, and there's birth, growth, and death. And that is like the engine of our operating system. And something about that authenticity and honesty you're talking about is the core of it. You know, everything else is just veneer. So I appreciate what you do, and I hope you keep doing it. And if you want to change course in life, I'll support you as a friend. But I like that your voice is out there and that you're still doing it. And I'm really happy that we were able to connect again.
Yeah, me too. It feels like it has not been that long, but it has been.
No. Well, it'd be cool if we could continue talking another time. I like talking to you, and I feel like we have lots of things we could talk about.
Yeah, definitely. I would love that.
In the meantime, where do folks find you or your work? They want to track.
Yeah, I have a website, which is just my name, christophershin.co. And I'm trying out this Patreon, which is like $2 a month, just to have access to these little articles I write, little meditations and analyses. Basically, I'm trying to build a spot on the internet for myself where there's something meaningful happening, and we can all engage together around the things I'm thinking about. So, you know, if anybody's interested in checking that out, it's an experiment. It's just been a couple months I've been doing it. But so far it seems like it could be something. So that's patreon.com/Chris_Shin. So that's sort of my, where I'm at on the internet these days.
All right. That's cool. And if for folks who aren't in New York or London, if they want to check out your place and just read them, they can find them, right?
Yeah. You can buy them online. You know, good libraries might have them, but, yeah, they're out there. And if somebody can't find a play of mine, or can't afford it, I might be able to send a PDF or something, so they could always email me through my website.
Awesome. Thanks. I really, really appreciated talking.
Thank you. It was great talking.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Chris. It's an amazing journey that some souls go on, and we all go on amazing journeys, but I knew the broad strokes. I'd heard about what had happened to Chris, but I hadn't heard everything, obviously, a lot. And hearing it from him is so powerful. And again, what I love about this podcast is being able to connect with people I know and that I don't know, and just sit down and listen for a while. It's such a powerful way to connect and to learn, and I hope you are learning too. If you do like this podcast, please review it. It makes a big difference. And I think we're at like 83 ratings on iTunes. You can rate podcasts on other services, wherever you listen to podcasts, but iTunes seems to be about 80% of you are listening on Apple in some form or another. So write a review, do a rating. If you've done it, you can already, you can do it again. And I like to read them, but it really kind of helps other people take the leap in checking this out and having this podcast grow. Another thing you can do is just share the podcast. You can post about it on social media or email it to a friend. All that makes a big difference. And you can always say hello at info@eastforest.org. This song that you're hearing in the background, it's just a little ditty recorded on the piano. So it doesn't have a title. Looks like the title is March 3rd, 2019, number 3, BPM 68. I know it sounds like a star galaxy or something, but that's what a lot of my songs start out as. It's just a date. I don't know if that'll become anything or not, but there it is. Just thought I'd share it with you. Hey, listen, you guys, keep walking your walk. Don't take any shit. But when you do, if you do, I think you might, please do it with grace. Peace.
filter out.